From the Land Grant University in Urbana-Champaign, Illinois, this is the Closing Market Report. It is the fourth day of October 2022. I'm Extension's Todd Gleason. Coming up in this half hour, we'll talk about the commodity markets with Wayne Nelson of AgMarket.net out of New Market, Indiana. And then a bit later in the program, Don Day will join us to discuss the harvest weather forecast for all of the Midwest. He says it might change next week, but things should be still pretty good all the rest of this week. You'll want to hear all the details a bit later. And along the way today, we'll talk with Jonathan Coppas, Agricultural Policy Specialist in the College of Agricultural, Consumer, and Environmental Sciences and the Department of Agricultural and Consumer Economics about yesterday's Supreme Court docket kickoff case. It dealt with the waters of the U.S., or the WOTUS rule, and he has some really good explanations as to what that really means and what the intent of Congress might mean. And we'll do all of that right here on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.
Todd Gleason's services are made available to WILL by University of Illinois Extension.
Oh, December corn today settled at $6.83. It was up 2.25. The March at $6.90, 2.5 higher. And the May at $6.91, up 3. November beans at $13.83.5, 9.5 higher. January $13.93.5, up 9.5. And March contract at $14.50.5, up 9.75 for the soybean. Bean meal down $3.80. Bean oil up $1.68. Beet futures soft red down 9 cents at $9.03. And the hard red unchanged at $9.88.75. Live cattle futures were down 52.5 cents, feeders down 85 for the day, and lean hogs off $3.30 at $74.42.5. Wayne Nelson of AgMarket.net now joins us. Hi, Wayne. Thanks for being with us. Let's talk about that AgMarket.net moniker. I know that you and Matt Bennett and Kurt Kimmel have been talking and working together on and off for some time. I bet that this is a really good move from L&M to AgMarket.net and just a transition for you over time.
I think, you know, it's a great thing for all three of us. And I think, you know, they've got a tremendous organization there, lots of information for our customers. I think that we're going to be able to share quite a few things that they do with all the resources that they have. And we've been, you know, good friends with Kurt and Matt for a long time and had a great relationship already before we started talking about this. But great individual thing for me and also for my customers.
Indeed. Hey, thank you for taking the time with us again today, too. I think it'll be a good thing. I know JSA, which is the parent company, has awful deep roots into the elevator system across the United States. What does it tell you about the marketplace?
Well, I mean, a lot of the talk this morning on our conference was about the elevator business out there now and the barge system and how we are, you know, only able to load 80% and the freight is so expensive that we're seeing a lot of the stuff move different ways by rail and truck and going into different markets and maybe even to different export markets because of it. So, you know, a lot of good information along that way. We were deep in the elevator business here for years, and it really helps to get a lot of that information to know what's happening in the cash market. And it's a lot like the good old days for me to actually listen to all these guys.
Yeah, so it's almost as if I hear you telling me like you have somewhat of what the Board of Trade used to be like when you would be able to call the pit up, I suppose.
Yeah, a lot of stuff. We've got a lot of very intelligent people, a lot of people that look at many different things. You know, everybody can't look at everything, but when you put 25 people on a conference call, you get 25 different views and a lot of good ideas and stuff what's going on. And that's what's really thrilling about it. You know, October 1st, why we switched over, and it looks like it's going to be a great thing for me is to have the extra knowledge as to talk about and relate and understand what's going on. Sometimes we don't understand what's going on in Chicago, but one of the 25 of us generally do.
So what do we think is going on in Chicago today?
Well, I mean, basically along the way, we saw the banks across the world not raise interest rates as much, ask the U.S. not to be pushing interest rates as far. They think that it's going to hurt the world economy and especially the poor nations. And that drove the idea that we won't be raising interest rates as much. And it really was a boon to the stock market, the crude oil also coming along the way. and a little bit of short covering after the sell-off after the report last week in the beans. So, you know, we're seeing that a little better attitude towards the grains if we aren't going to raise the interest rates as much as going along. And if we can see a little bit back in the stock market coming along to just sort of help everybody's feelings out there. So, but we're pushing up some real hard resistance at $7 in the corn and $14 in the beans. And we'll see if we can break through those and keep moving or not.
How long do we have to wait, do you suppose, before a decision as to which direction this thing will go might be? And do farmers need to be aware of it as they're bringing the crop in?
Well, probably on the 12th, we get the next government report. And we're going to see how they are really looking at this harvest. You know, later this afternoon, we're going to get some reports, I think, from FC Stone and or StoneX, I guess is how it's referred to now, see what they're looking at for their guesstimates for the report. And I think tomorrow we're going to get numbers out of Memphis. So, you know, a little bit of that. But there is, there is some carry in a lot of the areas, and with the harvest prices because of the very, very expensive freight on the river. And there's a lot of areas where there's really paying the farmer to carry it into December. And he has to look at his local base to see where those are, but along the river especially, because barge freight is one of the highest it's been ever since I can remember, the last 40 years.
Thank you very much. We'll talk with you again next week.
Thank you, Todd.
That is Wayne Nelson. He is with agmarket.net. USDA NAS has updated the weekly crop progress report. As of the second day of October, 96% of the corn crop has dented. The rolling five-year average there is 97%. 75% of the crop is mature. That's right on the five-year average. And 20% of the crop has been harvested. 22% is the five-year average. Soybeans dropping leaves set at 81% by USDA. 79% is the five-year average. And harvest of soybeans at 22% now is behind the 25% five-year rolling average. 40% of the winter wheat crop has been planted, and it's normally at a pace of 44%. About 15% of that crop has emerged. The five-year average emergence is 17%. Now, here are the updates from the statisticians in Iowa, Minnesota, and Illinois.
This is Rebecca Alter, statistician for the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office. Field work included harvesting row crops, chopping silage, and some fourth cutting of hay. Virtually all of Iowa's corn crop has reached the dent stage or beyond. 82% of Iowa's corn crop was mature, one day behind last year, but 4 days ahead of the average. Harvest of the state's corn crop reached 11% complete, 4 days behind last year and 1 day behind the five-year average. Moisture content of field corn being harvested for grain was at 22%. Corn condition dropped slightly to 61% good to excellent. 96% of soybeans were coloring or beyond. Soybeans dropping leaves were at 80%, 4 days behind last year and 1 day behind the five-year average. Soybean harvest reached 26%, 3 days behind last year, but 1 day ahead of the average. Farmers in northwest Iowa led the way with 45% harvested, while farmers in south central Iowa have harvested just 4%. Soybean condition fell slightly to 61% good to excellent. Pasture condition dropped to 28% good to excellent. Water for cows and calves on pasture continued to be an issue in areas of the state. Weaning was underway for some livestock producers. For the USDA NAS Iowa Field Office, this is Rebecca Alter.
This is Mark Schleusener, state statistician for Illinois with the USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service. Last week was cool and dry across Illinois. Rainfall was zero in most locations, and that was more than 1/2 inch below normal for this time of year. Temperatures averaged 55.3 degrees, more than 6 degrees below normal. 85% of Illinois corn acres have reached the dent stage, compared to 97% last year and 96% for the five-year average. 63% of corn acres have matured compared to 80% normally, and 13% of corn acres have been harvested compared to 29% normally. The condition of the Illinois corn crop was reported as 8% very poor to poor, 23% fair, and 69% good to excellent. Moving on to soybeans, 80% of acres were dropping leaves compared to 81 1 year ago and 75% normally. 10% of soybean acres have been harvested compared to 26 normally, and soybean conditions were reported as 9% very poor to poor, 24 fair, and 67% good to excellent. Winter wheat planting reached 4% finished compared to 11% 1 year ago and 14% normally. This has been Mark Schleusener with the Heartland region of USDA's National Agricultural Statistics Service in Springfield.
This is Doug DeCock in for Dan Loftus, the state statistician for the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office. Minnesota had 6.3 days suitable for field work. Much of the state saw its first frost of the season. Corn dented or beyond reached 98%. Corn mature was at 75%, 2 days ahead of the 5-year average. Corn harvested for grain was at 5%. Corn for silage was 85% harvested. Soybean coloring reached 99%, and soybeans dropping leaves was at 86%. Soybeans harvested was at 29%, 1 day behind the 5-year average. For the USDA NAS Minnesota Field Office, this is Doug DeCock.
And our thanks go to the state statisticians for their weekly updates of crop progress during the growing season. I'm University of Illinois Extension's Todd Gleason. The Supreme Court has convened for its latest docket, and we're now joined by Jonathan Kappas, agricultural policy specialist from the University of Illinois, to talk about what's on that docket and some of the changes at the Supreme Court in personnel in the last 6 months. Thank you, Jonathan, for being with us. First, what kinds of things will the Supreme Court take up this time around that might be related to agriculture?
Just looking at the docket of the cases they're going to hear this term, and I think everybody knows, you know, the basic process is the Supreme Court has to agree to hear a case called writ of certiorari, where somebody petitions to have their case heard, and the Supreme Court gets to choose what it wants to hear. So it has a docket of cases, and among them are the one that was argued yesterday, Sackett versus EPA, which involves the Clean Water Act and the definition of navigable waters under that. And the other one that is noticeable or notable from an agricultural perspective is the pork producers case suing California over the Proposition 12 that required space for hogs or banned the use of crates in hog production to sell pork into the state of California.
I'm wondering about this case from yesterday and what it says about the new makeup of the court with the addition of Ketanji Brown Jackson and some of the questioning she did, as I saw reported in Politico yesterday, that looked as if she wanted to move the court towards an intent of Congress definition, whether that be related to navigable waters or other things.
Yeah, and I did not have a chance to hear or listen in on the oral argument, so I'm like you, I'm kind of reading reports of it. And it looks like, as you mentioned, she was focused in on the intent of Congress, which is, you know, what we would consider kind of the basic role, or what should be the basic role of judges in the Article III branch of the government when they're interpreting statutes. What do the words of the statute say? What were the intent of Congress? You know, how do they define the terms they use? Sort of what were they, you know, one of the sort of, you know, overused phrases and sort of legal discussion is like, what was the main problem or the evil to which they were trying to get, right? There's this sort of sense that what is the problem Congress is trying to tackle. So in this case, it was water pollution. Clean Water Act was designed to clean up the nation's waters and prevent water pollution or reduce water pollution so that we had cleaner waters. So that was like the main purpose of the statute. And then that's the intent of Congress then that she's asking about. What did they intend by the words in the statute?
So we can't really interpolate much from what happened yesterday, but the case itself, I take it as it's related to the waters of the U.S., is fairly interesting because this is the second time it will be argued in front of the Supreme Court?
Well, it's a fascinating case for multiple reasons. What it does is it involves wetlands, and you're right, this is the second time this very case has been in front of the Supreme Court. Back in 2012, it looks like, the Supreme Court sent the case back down to the district court and remanded. Now, I've not had a chance to read that case yet, so I don't want to jump ahead of it, but it does look like through the procedural efforts, it was appealed to the Supreme Court, or appealed all the way up. The Supreme Court granted certiorari, sent it back down, and they've lost the Sacketts, the people who sued EPA here, have then lost again at the district court level, the appellate court level, and now are back before the Supreme Court on this question about wetlands and whether the Clean Water Act applies to them. Now, this has a much longer sort of history to it, in large part because in a rather infamous case called Rapanos or Rapanos, I think back in 2004, 2005, the court split over this question about how much of wetlands or what were the jurisdictional reaches under the Clean Water Act of the federal government over wetlands. So the statute uses the term navigable waters, and we can all conjure what we think of that. You know, the Mississippi River is clearly a navigable water. But it then, you know, as you go into lakes and streams and rivers and wetlands and other things, it becomes this obviously more difficult question that I think the Supreme Court made it even more difficult with its earlier decision, which it split. So there was a plurality opinion. So it was there was no majority really on one side of the issue or another. And so this has kind of been one of those challenging areas of the law since that decision. Both of the previous two administrations tried to put new regulations out and were sued. And so we sort of see this continuing dispute. And so this case involves a wetland around a lake up in Idaho.
Yeah, and the lake is simply that. It's not connected to any navigable water, as I would think of a navigable water, like the Mississippi River or something even smaller than that. And WOTUS, or the Waters of the U.S. rules, is important to agriculture because landowners have to, when they're thinking about bringing land in and out of production, consider what navigable waters are. And sometimes this is just a tricky situation.
Well, I mean, from just looking at the map, I mean, I would say Priest Lake is navigable. It's a very large lake. It doesn't have to be, you know, like a Mississippi River to be navigable. In fact, what Congress said in the statute, which the thing I find most interesting about these cases all the way back to the Rapanos case. So Congress used the term navigable waters, which is an old term that dates way back when we are talking about, you know, rivers and harbors and those sorts of things. But they define navigable waters as waters of the U.S. That's where we get the WOTUS, the W-O-T-U-S. So navigable waters are defined by Congress as the waters of the United States. And in the conference report that Congress produces to explain the legislation as it goes through the process, they explain that what they mean by that is not necessarily water, which is where this earlier case kind of got tangled up, but they say what we're talking about is the sort of constitutional jurisdiction. So what is the reach of the federal government to regulate in this space? And they basically tie it to what we would think of as the Commerce Clause. Like, as long as it has some Commerce Clause kind of thinking, as long as it has some sort of connection to or has an impact on. And so you can think of where this gets, you know, really hung up is if you're trying to look specifically at waters, then, you know, you may define it one way. But if you're looking at this ability for, say, pollution in one part of a watershed that gets into another part of the watershed, that may be different. And that's where the court has really kind of tangled itself up over the time, trying to, you know, draw legal lines in this sort of natural system where water moves from one part to another. And I think where Judge Brown Jackson was trying to get to is like, what was the intent of Congress? Was it to delineate what are waters, or was it to deal with pollution in water? And so that is where I think you'll see this argument really kind of breakout or focus as among the justices on the court.
Hey, thank you very much, Jonathan, for that explanation. It makes things clearer for me as I report in the future on this subject, and I'm sure we'll talk more again about it as well. Jonathan Kappas, of course, is an agricultural policy specialist on the Urbana-Champaign campus of the University of Illinois. Let's check the weather forecast now with Don Day. He is at Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming. It's been a beautiful couple of weeks across the Corn Belt for harvest season, or at least the beginning of it. The producers aren't very far along, as related to the crop progress report and harvest numbers from today. They'll be getting in the field a whole lot more over the next month and a half. I'm really, though, wondering about the next 5 to 7 days. Can you take me, Don, through the northwestern part of the Corn Belt and then work your way towards Ohio and give me an idea what producers can expect?
Well, first of all, those northern and western areas are the locations most likely to get a little bit of precipitation here over the next 5 to 7 days. This will be especially true across the eastern side of South Dakota, central and eastern Nebraska, up into Minnesota, Wisconsin, and also parts of Iowa. Now, I do not see anything really heavy with that shower activity, so I don't think it's going to be enough to make for muddy fields or too many problems. As you work south and east into the rest of the Corn Belt, it's a continuation, Todd, of the weather we've had over the last couple of weeks, which is a real lack of weather. We're still protected under some high pressure and some nice mild conditions here for probably another week or so. Now, after, let's say, the next 7 days, I will tell you there's a lot of disagreement on some of our long-range modeling about a potential change in the weather mid to late next week that would bring better precipitation chances and some colder weather. Enough disagreement where it's really hard to give you any really strong indicator of what may happen towards the middle of the month. It could end up being a lot colder and wetter, or we could stay under this high-pressure-dominated pattern for a little bit longer. But for the next 5 to 7 days, I see very favorable harvest weather.
I made note in weather over the decades that persistence is what generally takes place. Are you of the mind that will be the case so that the dry and warmer weather might win out, or is it just that iffy at this point?
Well, persistence forecasting certainly can work, especially once you get a pattern to hold for a little bit, because it tends to want to stay in a certain pattern for a while. And, you know, that is the trick in the longer range forecasts in the next 10 to 15 days or so, because we're getting deep enough into the month of October by next week that you usually do start to see changes to where that persistence forecast is a little bit less reliable.
Well, I guess we'll have to wait and see what you tell us about next week, and farmers will hope for persistence rather than cold and wet, I guarantee you. Thank you, Don, for taking the time with me today.
Thank you.
Don Day is with Day Weather in Cheyenne, Wyoming, joined us on this Tuesday edition of the Closing Market Report. It came to you from Illinois Public Media. It is public radio for the farming world.